No. It's not Christmas.
I know, but I finally found a Christmas song I love. Doesn't that make you happy?
No.
Is someone experiencing human joy around here? You get out of here with that. Hello, 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 everybody. I am Pedro.
And I am Meredith.
And this is Gritty Reboot, your favorite show about reboots that there's ever been. I just made the decision for you.
Good.
Yeah, see? I'm for everybody. It's great. It's better that way.
Yeah, all right.
It's better that way.
Hell yeah. Let's do this.
That's right. Let's do this. So, what are we doing this week, huh?
We are going through The Fog 1980.
A magical year. That last bit of the 70s peeking out. This is like the last gasp of like 70s horror right here. This film produced in 1979. This is a John Carpenter, one of his lesser works, but also has become a cult classic as well.
I like it.
Kind of weird how that works, but I think this is not considered to be right up there with Halloween and The Thing.
Yeah.
It's in the level with like Christine.
Christine.
Well, I do too. We're John Carpenter fans.
Yeah. That's why we
That's the problem. That's true. But we don't like Ghosts of Mars.
No.
We don't like vampires.
No.
No. Yeah, we don't
no,
like
No, no, no.
We don't like The Ward. Yeah. The Ghosts of Mars is a really bad movie. And I love John Carpenter, but that movie sucks. I think he would even tell you like, yeah, it kind of sucks.
Yeah.
Got away from him. Sometimes it happens. He wasn't the same without Deborah Hill.
Yeah.
It wasn't the same without Deborah Hill, who was his longtime producing partner. 2005, I do believe.
Damn.
2005, I do believe. Cancer. He always worked with John Carpenter up until a certain point. And this is one of those movies they made during this hot period. The Fog is a $1.1 million film that is somehow... Actually, it was made for a little bit less than. I listened to the commentary track. That's how much I love you guys. I whipped out the old DVD and listened to the commentary track that was recorded sometime after John Carpenter made the film Village of the Damned.
Oh, yeah.
So this is an authentic, like, 1993 recording session for Laserdisc. And it was interesting to hear a few things in there and a younger John Carpenter. Also, interesting fact in that commentary track, to hear them smoking.
Yeah.
Hear them smoking. Like John Carpenter just like taking a puff every now and then. You could still do that. You could smoke in a recording booth in 1993.
Yeah, why not? You can smoke everywhere. You can smoke on a plane.
You can smoke on a plane. You could smoke on a Dane.
Like, I remember seeing the ashtrays on the airplane.
Yeah. They're still there in some planes.
When I was a kid.
Yeah, but they're still there.
No.
Memory. They're still there.
No.
Yeah, they're still there.
Those planes are decommissioned, babe.
Oh, no. They're still there.
No.
So, if you get on a plane that has, like, an ashtray, how worried are you, right?
I'm getting off that plane.
Does this plane have a propeller? Is that why this is happening?
I'm taking extra gummies with me.
Extra gummies?
Yeah.
What kind of gummies?
It's CBD gummies. Yep.
Once again, this is Marathon Pedro Talk all about flying.
Yeah.
Your favorite show about flying and the ways to get through it.
Hell yeah.
This is once again not talking about The Fog.
Yeah, well, you know, you go with your bad self in the production, this bitch.
All right, so first off, before we get through anything, I want to throw out our socials. Guys, as always, please like, subscribe, give us a rating.
Yep.
Preferably a good rating. I mean, give us a bad rating, it's fine. I'll just rock myself to sleep while I cry. It's no big deal.
I'll be all right.
Yeah, she'll be fine. Or if you want to really get in person with us and let us know how much we do suck and we upset you, you can email us, grittyrebootcast@gmail.com. That's the most 90s way to get a hold of us. Or you can simply look up Gritty Reboot at Instagram or on TikTok while it is still not banned in the United States.
Yeah.
And that is probably the quickest way to get a hold of us and to send any comments. And also you can find little videos we make as well as little clips from the show. Rutabaker.
Rutabaker.
Rutabaker. So, Meredith, do you have any trivia on this film?
Yeah.
Do you?
No shit.
You're damn right, fuckface. All right, continue on.
Adrienne Barbeau patterned her voice after Allison Steele, who was a female DJ from the 1960s, who was also known as the Nightbird.
The Nightbird. Adrienne Barbeau has a fantastic voice.
Yeah.
I completely buy her as a radio DJ.
Yeah.
And that was a big problem I had in the other remake. Selma Blair was like, hello, here's my next song we're going to play. Yay, Anchor Bay. Antonio Bay. Something Bay. She very much did not have a radio voice at all. It reminded me of the DJ in Fallout 4. Like that level of awkwardness.
Yeah.
Yeah. You snow sold that entirely. He like nodded, like, yeah, no, you have to respond. So
I forgot.
Yeah. You're like, interesting.
You can't see me act out.
Yeah, that's right. That's how that works. It's an audio show. We got cameras there, but we don't turn them on.
Yeah, we don't need them.
We don't need them.
The lighthouse used in Point Reyes Lighthouse in Marin County, California.
California.
There are over 300 steps leading down to the lighthouse.
And we get a shot showing her go down every one of those motherfucking steps later in this movie.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. I was sure you put that in your notes. Because I was like, Carpenter, what the fuck are you doing? Just cut to her in the lighthouse.
Yeah, you see a hole.
Yeah.
Deal about it. I guess he was fascinated by that.
Yeah, they were. I mean, the movie has fantastic cinematography.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it when we get into the movie.
Father Malone's assistant at the movie's beginning is Bennett, who was also played by John Carpenter, but was uncredited. Carpenter felt he was so terrible in the role that he stopped acting in his movies except for Helicopter Pilots and Walk-Ons.
Body Bags.
Did he act in Body Bags?
Yeah, he's the fucking, he's the Crypt Keeper guy in Body Bags.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's the coroner. Well, you think he's the coroner, but he's actually a zombie.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a dead body. That's so weird. Yeah, I listened to the commentary track and he says that same thing about himself. And Deborah Hill brings up what I just said.
Oh.
Yeah. I just like, wait a minute, I just had deja vu. He literally says that exact same thing.
Hmm.
Yeah. Oh, strange.
Very.
Hey, this week you can listen to a commentary track. Hey, listen to commentary tracks, guys. Fantastic information about movies, and sometimes they're kind of fun. Carpenter's are always a really good listen to. Recommend his track on The Thing as well.
Yeah, but where do you find commentary tracks in the age of no media?
Oddly enough, you could find this on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the commentary track is on YouTube, so if you would like to do that, maybe if you found a way to download that file and simply just played it along, you know, on your iPhone while you watch the film, that would be a pretty equivalent experience. Or if you just want to get all the information in, you can listen to it on like 2x speed,
mm-hmm.
you know, without the film. But they're obviously going to reference things that you can't see. So that might be the downside.
That's a good tip.
That's why I didn't do it that way. But a lot of commentary tracks are on there if they're pretty good. And that one's a good track.
John Carpenter has stated two inspirations for this film, both of which are related to Great Britain. The first was the British film, The Crawling Eye in 1958. Which dealt with monsters hiding in clouds. He also stated that he and his co-writer, producer Deborah Hill, were inspired by a trip to Stonehenge, the ancient monument in southwest England, which was covered in fog during their visit.
This is a legit thing. They, as a listener to the track today, that is like the opening story they tell.
Yeah.
They talk about taking that trip, which they apparently had a great time on. Like, they reminisce about it really fondly. Like I said, if you're just a fan of, like, people sort of letting their guard down and being, like, regular people, this track has a lot of nice moments of that between him and Deborah Hill. They just tell a little nice story about the actual conception of the film, you know, and that sort of creeping him out and just trying to pencil together an idea and, like, over time, it really coming together. And, the story doesn't really come together in the movie, but the atmosphere is so strong it doesn't really fucking matter.
Yeah.
But it's sort of an interesting thing. Like it's interesting that he can chart that those two influences. Because I had a chance to actually watch the trailer to that movie, or a couple of clips from it, I should say. And it is pretty much that: is tentacle monsters coming out of the fog. Now the monsters look terrible, but I can understand how when he was 7, that could have been terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And they do have a great use of fog in the movie. Like there's a few kind of creepy shots, and they were clearly, you know, kicking around his head for a long time. This is probably the greatest use of practical fog I can really think of.
Yeah.
As it should be, being called The Fog.
Yeah, it looks way better than the 2005 movie.
Even though it is a $1 million, just a $1 million movie.
Yeah.
$900,000 for the initial shoot. That's how much the reshoot's worth, $200,000 on top.
Speaking of the fog special effects were accomplished using sound stages in Hollywood, and specially designed fog machines using dry ice fog juice, and optical effects. Miniatures were extensively used and combined with actual footage from the coast.
Yeah, so this is really cool. I don't know. I think you were looking at the reviews, but did you see that video about how they did like that compositing?
I don't believe so.
So what they were doing is obviously they were using the dry ice like you talked about. And what they did is they shot the house that they were looking to do for the fog effect. And they built the same house and they just blacked it entirely out. So they moved the fog around the shape and then just composite the shape of that fog in there. So it looks like it's interacting with the actual environment. And it's a really clever idea if you think about it.
Yeah.
Actually, and it looks pretty damn good even today, right?
Absolutely. It looks really good.
Now, granted, we did watch an ancient DVD, but this is one of the things I thought. I was like, these fog effects still look pretty nice. These old effects really hold up pretty well. I was pretty impressed by it. On the commentary track, they did talk about the dry ice bit, and they talked about the foggers that they used. I got to see them. They basically look like leaf blowers.
Mm.
And that's just a leaf blower blown out of just a ass ton of fog. It's what it is. They were able to do most of that with that. And Deborah Hill said there was a third way they didn't, couldn't remember what it was. I assume the third way they got it was just John Carpenter chain smoking right at the end of a day.
Yeah.
I mean, like John Carpenter is legendary chain smoker. Like, that is the kind of guy he is. And I just assumed he was like, it's not thick enough this time. Hold on, guys. Like one last puff to make sure it was the perfect consistency for a shot.
Yeah. Golly. And she died of lung cancer.
I do believe so. Yes, I do believe so.
Sucks.
Yeah. Always fucking sucks.
All right. Would you like to say anything else about the production or anything?
No, not really. I think you did a really good job covering like the genesis of the project.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those things. A Carpenter hadn't made a movie. Well, Carpenter hadn't had a theatrical production in 2 years. He'd actually made a pair of TV movies. He had made Elvis with Kurt Russell, which was a miniseries. And that was pretty well reviewed, as a matter of fact. And, you know, he made another TV movie as well where he met his wife, Adrienne Barbeau, on. And I just forgot the name of that TV movie. And I've never seen it. I've seen Elvis, but I've never seen that one. And I've been meaning to check it out for years because people have told me it's a very conventional but very tight thriller. But I've never, ever checked it out. And like I said, I feel bad I can't remember it right now. Maybe I'll splice in just a quick clip of me just shouting the name at the computer later. But this was his return to the theater, or return to cinemas. And, you know, it wasn't as big a hit, but I mean, this still made like $21 million.
Yeah.
So that's a ton of money. And even like I said, over time, the reputation of the film just grew to what it is today. And we think it's pretty well deserved. I think we both look at this film pretty favorably.
Yeah.
Even without nostalgia, I think it's greater than some of its parts is basically what I'm getting at here before we actually get into the movie.
I like it. I think it's fun.
Meredith
just jumped.
Almost midnight. Enough time for one more story. One more story before 12. Just to keep us warm. In 5 minutes, it'll be the 21st of April. 100 years ago, on the 21st of April, out on the waters around Spivey Point, a small clipper ship drew toward land. Suddenly, out of the night, the fog rolled in. For a moment, they could see nothing, not a foot ahead of them. And then they saw a light. My God, it was a fire burning on the shore. Strong enough to penetrate the swirling mist. They steered a course toward the light. But it was a campfire like this one. The ship crashed against the rocks. The hull sheared in two. The mast snapped like a twig. And the wreckage sank with all the men aboard. Bottom of the sea lay the Elizabeth Dane with her crew, their lungs filled with salt water, their eyes open and staring into the darkness. And above, as suddenly as it had come, the fog lifted, receded back across the ocean, and never came again. but it is told by the fishermen and their fathers and grandfathers that when the fog returns to Antonio Bay, the men at the bottom of the sea, out in the water by Spivey Point, will rise up and search for the campfire that led them to their dark and icy death. 12 o'clock, the 21st of April.
Which is not today, because we're not good with timing.
Yeah.
Not at all. Is all that we see or seem but a dream within a dream? It's the opening quote by Edgar Allan Poe. It's really got nothing to do with the rest of the movie.
Mm-mm.
But it's just some bit to set the mood, as this scene does right here. And I was going to read this whole bit out, and I was like, no, let me just play the goddamn clip, because that would just be way easier than doing anything else. And this is a reshoot, and it really does set the mood. I love this scene. That's why, like I said, I wanted to play it.
It doesn't affect me in the same way.
Doesn't affect you in the same way?
No, I think it's inconsequential.
Well, I think, honestly, you really need it, or else you don't understand what's going on in the story.
Well, you can...
I mean, if you really think about it, you would have no fucking concept of what this narrative's about.
Yeah, that's true.
Even then, the story isn't the best told story of Carpenter's career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't do the same thing for me. Yeah. It does for you.
That was a painful experience for you just listening to that now. You're like, why are you wasting my time, sir? All right, let's continue.
All right, you ready to rock and roll?
No, I'm not. But I'll cry to myself.
Well, this movie starts much in the same way as the 2005 one, with a pocket watch in firelight. It's 11:55 p.m. and an old man tells a story to a bunch of kids, which we talked about.
Yeah. I covered it. It's fine.
A man is listening to Stevie Wayne on the radio. He owes a talk to the Father Malone. The guy's name is Bennett, and it's John Carpenter.
Yeah, this is his quick little cameo in the film. Yeah. He speaks here with Hal Holbrook.
And he asks to get paid, but the priest kind of ignores him.
Carpenter, I mean, he hates his performance, but it's just whatever.
Yeah.
He has a line. That's it. Who cares? Can I get paid? And then Halbrook does. He doesn't respond. he no-sells it.
Yeah.
Which I like.
He leaves, and then shortly after, the father calls after him. He turns around to find a rock has fallen from the stone wall to reveal a journal.
And this is one of the weird, an oddly staged or blocked shot, or at least I always think it is. Like, Carpenter is sort of a master of blocking. Like, he'll back and watch the thing. Like, he effortlessly puts like 8 men in a small room, and it doesn't really seem like crowded or look strange. And in this movie, there are a few times where I think that kind of falls apart on him. As I said, I don't think he's at his sharpest here, but this is one of those scenes. I think it's oddly shot, and I do believe from the commentary track, this rock coming down in the middle of his office was a reshoot. I think he just kind of stumbled onto it before, and now they could have had like a ghostly reveal to it, which I think sort of adds to the ghost thing of the plot. But apparently this plot was very murky. It's still a little murky.
Next, you hear a bunch of phones going off and a man sweeping up a grocery store. He grossly takes a drink of OJ and then puts it right back.
Yeah, it was the 70s. It's fine.
That's disgusting.
It's fine. It's not like AIDS or anything. It'll be fine.
Ew.
Yeah. Everybody lives. He gets juice. It's fantastic. They shot all that shit by natural light. Literally just went out there at the 11th hour, just grabbed those shots.
He hears a bottle break and then everything starts to shake and rattle. Like there's an earthquake, but there's not an earthquake. Or is there?
There's the fog.
Foggeth cometh.
The foggeth cometh.
Mm-hmm.
The ghosts are making their way in. And this is what's really different than what we saw last week. Last week was just a movie. Like, it just was a thing. Yeah. This is a ghost story, first and foremost, and almost to a limiting way. You know, this movie really sets out to only be like a campfire ghost story.
Yeah.
And that kind of filmed. That's basically what Carpenter has filmed here. And it ends up being light on story, but this movie, because of the Carpenter's work and the amazing work of legendary cinematographer Dean Cundey, I mean, the guy who worked with Spielberg and John Carpenter and Robert Zemeckis, this guy in the 80s was gold. So it really has this beautiful look to the film, and it's just haunting in almost every frame, even during the day at times.
Yeah. Lights turn on suddenly at a gas station and gas starts pumping all over the grounds. Bells go off, a hydraulic lift goes off, and a bunch of cars. And then we meet Nick Castle, who's just driving along listening to the radio.
This is Tom Atkins.
He picks up a young Jamie Lee Curtis.
A young Jamie Lee Curtis. She's 22 here.
Yeah. She's a baby.
Yeah, a little baby Jamie Lee
Curtis. Baby Jamie Lee
Curtis. She's going to jump all over 45-year-old Tom Atkins' bones. Ugh. Yeah.
Yeah, she immediately fucks
him. She's got daddy issues, and Nick Castle's here to clean up the mess.
Her name is Elizabeth,
and she at the end of the story will become a ghost.
No,
that's the other one. You don't want the ghost line storyline back.
Mm-mm.
Shame.
Mm. While they are driving, all the windows in the truck break.
Here's what I love about this is like this
they
really
like no sell it.
Yeah, and what's so strange is the remake does this too, and it's the only reason they do that is because they do it in this one.
Yeah.
And I was like, you should have fixed that. That was stupid in this version. Like, there's like, whoa. All right. And like this. If we were driving somewhere, and even if our daughter was just you and I, like we didn't have a concern for somebody else, and all of our windows blew out, we'd be like, what the hell kind of supernatural shit just occurred here?
Mm-hmm.
And we should get the hell out of here. Whatever. Like, that would scare the living piss out of me. And they're just like, well, you know, shit happens, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Antonio Bay, what are you going to do?
Yeah. I don't know.
Every now and then it bugs me in a horror movie when something really like supernatural happens. People are like,
it's crazy.
Well, you know, I get swamp gas.
Well, it's April 21st, the town anniversary. It's been 100 years. That's basically what Stevie is sounding off over the radio.
Yeah. Stevie's the main character, right?
Yeah.
This is a very much an ensemble piece if you think about it, because we're bouncing between Tom Atkins and Jamie Lee Curtis. Then we have Stevie. And then we have the fog.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because that's really just sort of going from there. And we have her son later. He branches off in his own storyline.
So, yeah. Dan calls from the weather station. He tells them a boat called the Seagrass that is 15 miles out, that there is a fog bank to worry about. And then we go to the men on the ship.
Yeah. We immediately teleport to see the guys on the ship.
Yeah.
And they're a fun group. They're piss drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And
Budweiser.
Yeah, as they get the warning from Stevie, they are talking about how hot she is.
Mm-hmm.
And the weatherman also, the meteorologist, by the way, he's not like a weather guy.
Dan.
Yeah, Dan, he also has the hots for Stevie, even though he can only hear her.
Yeah.
To his credit, Adrian Barbeau has a very sexy voice.
Yeah.
I really can't imagine her as like radio DJ extraordinaire.
All right, so the men on the ship see the fog bank rolling in. They see kind of light in the fog. And they're like, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah, weirdly enough, in this movie, the fog is one of the most lit things in every shot.
Yeah.
Which is kind of strange if you think about it.
It's beautiful, though.
Yeah, there really is a great beauty to it.
The fog seeps onto the boat and breaks the engine. It's now engulfed them. They see a big ship, and then it disappears.
So
they see a ghost ship.
This was about the only time I think the remake had a really cool shot.
Mm-hmm.
Was when they showed the ghost ship. I think it was the only time it might be superior because you see a little bit more detail in the ship. But that is literally the only time they outmaneuver Dean Cundey in this entire sequence. There's a nice little bit of reverse motion for the fog there when it's brought into the engine. I like that. Mm-hmm. It gets sucked in there and like just completely chokes it.
They start to see figures in the fog. And then one by one, the men get stabbed to death by the ghosts.
I did discover that most of this is a reshoot, what we see in the movie. They basically, I think the ship scene was always there where they see the Elizabeth Dane. But the deaths were redone to be a little bit more graphic. As I talked about before, they were kind of shooting for a PG and Carpenter realized they weren't going to get it and they needed to be a little bit more graphic. So this is one they redid to really amplify the terror in it.
Hmm.
And that's why you get a little bit more contact with the weapons in this scene than some of the other deaths.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, because it's kind of like real quick and visceral.
Yeah. And of course obviously the Carpenter imagery is there with these shadowy figures, but fog is something that really helps this idea that he has really early in his career.
Yeah.
Because even in Assault on Precinct 13, those gang members are just standing there in the distance with their weapons. They're not like lunging forward at a lot
of points.
They're
in the shadow.
Yeah. They're just like figures out in the distance. You know, they're there, but they're not moving just yet. Just like Michael Myers.
Light that.
I do not believe so. I do not believe so. I don't think he worked with Dean Cundey till Halloween. Yeah, because that was the first time he worked with Deborah Hill, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
I'd have to take a look. I don't know offhand.
Well, one man's left inside the cabin, but a ghost come for him.
Yeah, and this is probably one of the odder things. The ghost just kind of opens the door and then slowly comes after him.
Yeah, he gets stabbed.
Doors mean really nothing to these fog ghosts.
No. The other ones had to, like, seep in.
Mm-hmm.
But these, they don't give a shit.
Yeah, they'll open the door, they'll knock it down. We'll see them later, they're trying to knock it down with a hook.
Yeah. Good old Dan calls again and tells Stevie that the fog has moved and it's going against the wind, which is really weird.
Yeah, Stevie kind of points that out, that that's incredibly strange.
Yeah.
I do like that eventually, like, little things about this do grab her attention.
Well, yeah, because all her gauges are saying things are going one way, and all his gauges are saying things are going another way, mm-hmm. so there's conflict.
Yeah.
Good talk.
Yeah, good talk, yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
I had nothing to add from your point.
I could tell. We're with Nick and Elizabeth now, and it's obvious that they just got done banging.
So, once again, 45-year-old Tom Atkins beds 22-year-old Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah.
In every middle-aged man's dream. I like Tom Atkins a lot, so it doesn't bother me. And I don't think it's particularly creepy because she's into him. Sure, yeah. There's an age difference thing, but it's whatever, right?
She's 22. It's not like she's 18.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a big difference.
There's a big difference. It's called 4 years.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of difference.
Yeah. They actually have really good chemistry, and they're talking in this scene a lot post-coitus.
Yeah, and that's the thing. They do have chemistry, so you don't really doubt it. Like,
no.
It is just one of those things where, sure, it's just a hookup through town. Or whatever, but they do really seem to like each other. We have no idea how this thing occurs. We don't get a fog, too. So
they hear a knock at the door that keeps knocking and knocking and knocking until he answers the door. And
right as he answers the door, his clock
breaks.
Yeah, his grandfather clock cracks and breaks right at the stroke of one.
Well, when he gets there, no one's there.
The witching hour has passed.
Mm-hmm.
The fogging hour, whatever we want to call it.
Next day, Andy is on the beach going fishing, and he finds a board with the word Dane scrawled on it.
Well, he finds a gold coin.
Yeah.
And he
finds a lot, actually.
He finds a gold coin. He reaches down for the gold coin, and it transforms into this piece of wood.
Mm-hmm.
I like how he tells his mom that. She's like, oh, yeah, really great. But then again, that's how I would react if our daughter said, oh, I found this gold coin to transform this piece of wood. Oh, it's fascinating. Good stuff.
Yeah.
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 It's just kid's imagination, right?
Hell yeah.
It's not some ghost curse.
Yeah. You wouldn't believe that at all.
No. I mean, maybe now I would.
Well, he comes back and he goes to wake up his mother.
Yeah, he wakes her up early, which pisses her off.
Yeah.
Which is to be fair, because she was doing the late shift till 1.
Yeah, apparently she
was. The radio station has very limited hours.
Mm-hmm. We're back with Nick and Elizabeth, who are at the docks because he's worried about his buddy Alan and his crew, who haven't come back from the seagrass.
Yeah, basically, it's just not like them to come in. Even shit-faced, they'll find their way back into shore.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't even do that, which is really strange.
So he charters a boat and goes out there and, you know, looks for his buddies.
Yeah, he takes his ship out there. And I did learn a fun fact from the commentary track that everybody except for Tom Atkins was seasick on that little boat.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Like Carpenter, I think like the second assistant camera or something like that ended up being like one of the few people who wasn't like vomiting. So like he was in charge basically of shooting that one little sequence.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause they brought like 5 people on there that weren't the actors and they were all sick.
Shit.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a rough scene for them. Rough scene.
Yeah. I've been seasick before.
Nothing you can do. Like so they had to get that shot. And so that's what it was.
I had to sleep. That's the only way I could get rid of it.
Yeah.
That's when I went deep sea fishing with my dad. I don't recommend it.
I love the sea.
No, you don't.
I do. I only have one true mistress. The sea!
You go out there deep where all the sharks are.
Yeah, that's where I want to go. I can fight a shark.
But, no, that's not you at all.
Yeah, I love fighting sharks.
Yeah, you act like it happens every day.
Well, I fought that one back in 98. And, you know, sure, you got the best of me, but I'm still here.
How old were you in 98?
It's not important. It's not important.
I think it is.
No, it's not important.
I call bullshit.
No. I was doing some wild stuff back in the 90s.
Anywho.
Anyway, back to shark wrestling with Meredith and Pedro.
Town lady played by Jamie Lee Curtis's mother.
Town lady. I love your descriptions, but yes, she is the lady of the town. Janet Lee is the, and by the way, so you're not alone here, on the commentary track, Deborah Hill thought she played the mayor, and Carpenter had to correct her that she was not playing the mayor. She's like just a booster, basically, for the whole city council, or for the city itself.
I never wrote down her name, so she's Town Lady.
Town Lady, that's all.
And her assistant, Sandy.
Legally, that is her name. You wrote down her assistant's name?
Yeah.
What's the matter with you?
I don't know. It's the way I work. Anywho, her assistant, Sandy, talk about the ceremony downtown today for the town's birthday. And then we go to back to Nick, where he spots the seagrass.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we go back to Mrs. Williams, the town lady, who tells her assistant that her husband hasn't come home yet.
It's Kathy Williams, by the way.
And she kind of no-souls it.
Yeah, because, I mean...
She's like, I got shit to do.
She's like, he'll be fine.
He's
like,
drunk.
Yeah, like, he'll be fine. He knows the shore.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that he's weak to are ghost pirates.
Yeah.
And that's not going to happen.
We're back with Nick, and he boards the seagrass to look for their friends. They discover that there's water in the generator, but the deck is dry.
Yeah, so basically everything leads them to believe the ship was somehow submerged, and there's not a drop of evidence of that in place.
Mm-mm. We're back with Mrs. Williams, who goes looking for Father Malone in the church. The father becomes ominously out of the dark to scare Mrs. Williams.
You know, and this is incredibly ominously out of the dark. This is a little effect, by the way. They darken the background. Not digitally, but they used a processing technique to darken it. And it's actually a fade into the regular shot. So he does literally come out of nowhere.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so they did a little manipulation there to make it seem even more like he pops out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And apparently he got a huge reaction in the theater. But it's a jump scare and a half.
He reads the journal that he's been reading this whole time, but he reads it aloud this time, Father Malone does.
Yeah, so this is really the first time they get introduced in this element of the story where we have... Well, in this one, it's not really established she's a descendant of any of the original conspirators.
Yeah.
Because technically, I do want to mention this right now in case there's any actual super fans out there of The Fog. There is a novelization of The Fog. And in that novelization, it goes out of the way to stress that every single person in the movie who is killed is a descendant of those six original conspirators.
Yeah.
The movie doesn't really say that or make that clear at all. But the remake flirts with that idea a little bit, but then just kills like nine people, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to mention, technically, I guess that would be canon. Not that there's like a Fog franchise.
No, there's not sequels to this movie. I don't know why.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd think they released on one.
Fog is everywhere, right?
Yeah, yeah. They joke about a sequel on the commentary track back in 93.
I wonder what they would have done, though.
You probably just do the same thing again.
Another curse?
Yeah. Well, actually, Carpenter's really bad at sequels.
Mm.
Yeah, because Halloween 2 is just okay, and he only wrote that. And then... Escape from L.A. is really lousy. That's a strange, strange movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a self-parody of his own, of the first movie.
Yeah, it's a weird
movie. Yeah, I'd really, to this day, that'd be the one I would ask him about, because like, what the hell are you trying to do with this?
Yeah.
Whatever it was, Kurt Russell loved the idea too.
Nick and company inspect the seagrass. They see the gauges that are all broken inside, and the glass is all shattered.
And they both connected to what happened to them the night previously.
Yeah. They go down below deck. We're here with Father Malone again. He continues to read, exchanging flashbacks on their...
She is confused by her notes. Give her a minute. She'll get there. Dormammu.
I don't know. Well, Father Malone continues to read out of the journal that he's been reading this whole time.
Yeah, he basically tells them, and it's just an account of how they screwed the guys over.
Mm-hmm.
You'd lit a campfire to send them into the water. Into the, not the water, but the rocks.
Nick, he tells about a mysterious ship his father boarded that was completely abandoned. His father took a Spanish doubloon, but when he went home to give it to his son, it disappeared. And then at this moment, this is when they get scared by the bodies.
Yeah, we have a big jump scare as like Jamie Lee Curtis moves forward. And one of the corpses. Yeah, one of the corpses just falls forward. I watched a blooper reel today, and they had the other version of the scare where she just kind of opens a drawer and a body's there. So this is a better version of that.
Yeah.
Even though if it is weird, he just kind of comes to life. But he'll come to life again, so it's fine.
Yeah. The father finishes the passage from the journal, and he's kind of ominous about talking about there'll be murderers tonight.
Yeah, you know, this is based off a real thing. Did we talk about that last time?
No.
The ship against the rocks?
No.
Yeah, this is based off a thing that actually did occur. It wasn't gold. I think it was opium and porcelain, I think, is what was actually on the ship.
Huh.
But it was the same idea. They basically led the ship astray into the rocks. They didn't get the help of fog, though. That's sort of where the ideas came from. And I think this is off the coast of New England is where this original story takes place. But I don't know if that's one of the inspirations necessarily, but it is one of the things that what was a basis for the mini story or the background within this movie.
Now we're with Stevie. She makes her way back to the radio station. She comes in and lays the wood plank with Dane on it down. She lays it kind of on top of her little tape deck.
As one would back then. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, she has a tape deck, so why is she just looping the promo over and over again? Why didn't she just like put like an hour's block of music on that?
Yeah, right?
Yeah, and then just like put an hour's block on the other side. Well, I don't know if they had self-reversing tape drives in like 1980, but good with the times. Give the people something to listen to besides the promo over and over again.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah, you just turn it off during the day. You get no other stations over there because of the rocks.
Yeah.
I'm sure you get something.
Pretty awful.
Terrible. No one should live there.
Father Malone talks of curses and acts real strange. Mrs. Williams and Sandy, they're just like, we're leaving.
Yeah, because they still have to continue to go forward. Yeah, I mean, they understand that. I mean, this is obviously horrible to find out that the Founding Fathers were fucking murderers and conspirators and shit. But there isn't a whole lot they can really do about that. But they still have to celebrate the town and do their jobs.
Yeah.
It sucks for Father Malone, but he will be fine. Actually, he won't be. But theoretically, he would have been fine.
Back to Stevie. We see the Dane plank, and it starts seeping with water and drips on her electrical equipment.
And yeah, we actually get, this is a very cool moment.
Eventually bursting in flames.
Something that once lived with like an albatross around the neck, now more like a millstone, a plumbing stone, by God. Damn them all.
Yeah, and like she said, it just bursts into flames right there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a neat little moment because it's one of the creepier things that happened in the movie. It's not really jam-packed full of scares, but I think the coolest thing about it is everything was not real.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she immediately turns back around and there was no fire, there was no water leaking.
Yeah.
It was just in her head. I guess there's still fire extinguisher particles everywhere.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
That would have gotten everywhere.
That would have
ruined it more than anything.
Would it?
I think so.
It's just a gas.
Yeah, but it's like a powder and stuff that gets on it.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm not a 1980s fire extinguisher expert. But let me tell you, man, Sammy was ready. Like, she was just like, fire. I've been waiting for this moment for years.
Yeah.
Like, she had that fire extinguisher out and ready to go.
That's her livelihood.
Yeah, props to her. She loves that live station radio house that only she works at. It's a very strange place.
Stevie calls Andy asking where he got that piece of wood from.
Yeah, because now she's really intrigued because she almost fake burnt to death.
She tells him not to pick up anything else from the beach. She makes him promise not to leave the house tonight. And then we see the coroner's notes, the injuries on Alan, the dead guy.
And I think this scene is significantly stronger than what's in the other film.
Mm-hmm.
I like this one a lot. I love the way the blocking is, like when he slowly rises from behind her. But the other thing I love about the scene is that we're given a lot of information here. And none of it is like definitive about what's occurring. It all just adds the mystery and the ambience of this whole thing. Once again, this whole movie is just about this atmosphere. And it leads to this thing to where, you know, I just saw this guy 3 days ago, but it looks like he's been under the water for a month.
Yeah. Elizabeth ends up getting left alone with the dead body.
Which always works out well in horror movies.
Mm-hmm. The body starts to move.
So yeah, the fog is a low-key zombie movie.
Mm-hmm. The coroner and Nick talk about the weird circumstances of his friend's body.
Oh, they're dances.
Circumstances. Nice.
Nice.
Noise.
Noise.
The body comes towards Elizabeth. Elizabeth attacks her, then writes 3 on the floor before collapsing.
Yeah, that was his last wish, was just to write the number 3. Which either says we have three or there are three more to go. Either way, the meaning is clear. You know,
yeah.
You're halfway there. They are really, really set on just the three people. Because I feel this one, and also the 2005 film, missed an opportunity for like a Fog Massacre.
But why did they kill the old lady and try to kill the boy?
Because the old lady's the descendant.
But what about the boy?
He was living with the descendant.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, Stevie's the descendant. That's why they go after her. But they only needed six people. There's a bunch of people that are related to the original descendants. You know how much inbreeding was in Antonio Bay? Let's not even get into that.
Wow.
I'm just saying. Half the towns related to each other, of course everyone's a descendant. They got their pick.
Ew.
I'm spitting facts at you.
No, you're not.
Yeah, I am.
Bullshit.
This Carpenter confirmed this in the commentary track. Tons of incest. Incest
and incest.
Tons of incest at Antonio Bay. It also smelled quite nice because of the incense. It was a requirement to all the incest regulations.
Yeah.
It was a very strange city council that year.
All right. The police tell Mrs. Williams that they are still looking for her husband. She's still pretty worried.
Yeah, now she's legitimately concerned.
Yeah. Stevie broadcasts that the Coast Guard found the seagrass. Nick calls Stevie and asks about the fog. She tells him the fog she saw last night was glowing and moving against the wind.
She just gives up all the info to Nick, by the way. I don't know if she knows Nick. You know, what was weird is I laughed at myself because I was like, well, they had a relationship previously. And I thought to myself, like, no, they didn't. That was in the remake. That wasn't in this movie. Well, I don't know that. I don't know if that's canon. But either way, she just gives him all the information she knows about the fog. Because Stevie won't talk to anybody, basically. Mm-hmm. She loves talking.
We see Dan driving to the weather station.
Yeah.
He calls Stevie about the fog. He says the fog should be there in about 10 minutes. Nick and Elizabeth hear this and head to the station. She tells Dan the fog glows and she thinks it's weird. Dan says the light went out and the temp is dropping.
Yeah, so they put a few connections here of other things that go along with fog appearing.
Mm-hmm. Dan goes to check on who is knocking at the door, and Stevie is on the other line. She's urging Dan not to answer the door.
Yeah.
But he does anyways.
Yeah, because he doesn't understand any of this stuff yet, and Stevie can't be like that clear with him just yet. Like, hey, I think there's some sort of demon or something in the fog.
Yeah.
She doesn't really. Here's the thing: Stevie doesn't know the other half of this story part. She doesn't know anything about the pirates. She doesn't know anything about that. To her, just killer fog shows up and there's some zombie motherfuckers in it.
Yeah,
that's all that she knows about.
Unfortunately, a ghost comes to kill Dan.
Yeah, and we get basically puts like a scythe right in him and then pulls him off screen.
Yeah.
Once again, it is bloodless, but you do see a little bit of contact. Penetration, if you will.
Penetration.
The penetration.
Mrs. Williams makes a speech.
She does. So they are to honor. By the way, this statue is like a miniature, right?
It's so tiny.
It's a little tiny statue to commemorate the 100 years. All this town could afford was the whatever the small art department of the fog could put together for a fake statue.
They should have just went to like a college and got a local artist from there to make them something.
Maybe they wanted it to be specific. Maybe they wanted to be specific and they had a really good idea and they just ran out of time and they ended up with just like the miniature they built for it.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. I don't know. They didn't say anything about it. On the track, I thought he was going to say, like, oh, we meant to do this, but no. Maybe it was a plan all along. It was going to be crummy.
Hmm. Stevie gets on the radio again and makes a plea to the police. He goes to call her, but the fog takes out the phones. The fog engulfs the power station and shuts it down, taking out all the lights.
Yeah,
even at the lighthouse.
Our ghost lepers know exactly where to attack to cripple the city.
Yeah.
It's very impressive if you think about it.
Stevie goes to turn on the generator.
Yeah, she sees the fog moving, and she's in a rush immediately to get this thing going, to get the warning out to anybody who was going to be listening to the radio, which realistically can't be that many people at this point.
Yeah.
The power's out.
No kidding.
Yeah. So the only people we're going to hear would be people in our car. Now, it doesn't matter, because at the end of the movie, the only people to follow her directions are the main cast.
Yeah.
No one else in town.
The ones that matter.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, no random person shows up. Because I made that joke when we watched the other movie, when she's begging for help for her son. Like, what's Tom Welling do if he gets there? There's like 30 guys there already ready to rescue the kid. Like, oh, hey, what you take? No, you.
Nick and Elizabeth make it to the weather station. And then we have Andy's babysitter. She sees the fog roll in. She tells Andy, go shut the windows.
Yeah, she's instantly kind of creeped out by the fall.
Yeah. Stevie finally gets the generator going, and she makes her plea for her son to get out of the house.
Yeah, and their power's out, so obviously they don't have the radio going or anything like that. No. So, you know, I mean, obviously you can get a battery-powered radio easily in 1980. It's what you would have had, but you probably would have had it. Well, I guess you would have, well, somebody would have to be in the lighthouse if there's a bad storm and Stevie's not up there.
There's a knock at the babysitter's door. She goes to answer it, but it's just thick fog and a light. She tells Andy to go back to his room because he's watching this whole time.
Yeah, and like the second he turns his back and shuts the door, the ghost pirates reach in and pull her into the fog. And that's it. They just pull her into the fog. Nothing else.
Then the fog comes to knocking on Andy's door.
Yeah, they do that slow, creepy knocking. The fog slowly coming underneath the actual door itself.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also like pounding through the actual door with their hooks and their weapons and everything like that.
Yep, they start breaking the door down. We're back with Nick, who reaches Andy just in time. They get in the truck and haul ass, but the truck is stuck. The ghosts start to surround the vehicle.
And this is really tense.
And they finally break.
Even though it's a really slow buildup for this whole thing, I thought this was really tense with them getting closer and closer and them trying to rock the vehicle back and forth and get it going again.
Yeah.
I thought this was surprisingly effective. I didn't remember this, but watching it back again, like I said, I was taken aback by how much I enjoyed this bit.
We get a scene with Stevie, who talks to Andy and tells him she's sorry and she's not there, but she has to stay on the radio.
And she doesn't have to.
Updates on the fog.
Yeah. But she is the only way people could ever get information. There's no other way people would know what was going on if Stevie isn't the one giving them information they can't hear because they don't have their radios on because the power went out.
Sandy drives Mrs. Williams home. The fog looks like it's kind of chasing Nick and Elizabeth through the streets of the city.
It's a pretty impressive effect when you think about it. It does a nice job looking like it is after them.
Stevie broadcasts that the safest spot is the old church on Beacon Hill.
Yes, the whole town goes there, or just our four primary leads.
Yeah. Nick, Elizabeth, Miss Williams, and Sandy are all at the church, and the fog is coming for them. And then the fog comes for Stevie. Father Malone, he's just blabbing drunkenly about the curse.
Yeah, he's pretty drunk at this point. I wouldn't say he's shit-faced, but he's pretty drunk.
Back with Stevie, there's a knock at the lighthouse door. Stevie and the ghost breaks into through the window. They are trying to penetrate the church, and Miss Williams, Sandy, and the Father Malone fend off what they can.
Yeah, there's a nice last stand here in the church, even though I think this scene could be paced significantly better. This is probably one of the weaker elements of the movie. I think this finale could weirdly enough, this is things that Carpenter's done quite well in like Assault and Precinct 13, but this is a lesser version of those sort of final stands.
In the meantime, the ghosts break into Stevie's lighthouse, and she gets on the outside and she goes up onto the roof. Father Malone takes a giant cross out to the rectory and sees the ghost. It's a rectory, right?
Yeah.
Okay. One of the ghosts comes towards him. We're back with Stevie, and she's on the roof of a lighthouse trying to escape.
But the cross-cutting is nice going back and forth.
Blake's ghost has red eyes. Father Malone says to take him. He's the last conspirator. Stevie gets stabbed by a ghost.
One came up from behind.
The main ghost grabs a giant cross, and it starts to glow. Nick clubs the priest, basically.
Well, he grabs him and like suplexes him backwards to get away from it because it's glowing like red hot.
And all of a sudden, the ghosts disappear.
Everywhere. Stevie's clean. The town's clean. You see a montage of the fog leaving all the locations we saw pass by earlier.
Everything seems to go back to normal. And then we have Stevie broadcasting about the fog and what a nightmare this night has been. And she has this great line, look across the water into the darkness, look for the fog.
Yeah, and this is a reference to a film we've already covered, The Thing from Another World. Carpenter referenced it then a few years before he would go on to make The Thing.
Father Malone thinks it's over. The ghosts have come back to kill him.
Yeah, I do love that. He's like, oh, Blake, why would you not take the sixth person? Oh, well, and he stands up and right behind him, Blake goes to decapitate him. And it cuts to black right before he gets his head chopped off. And so ends John Carpenter's The Fog. This is a movie that I think is a bit like Suspiria, that it's about the atmosphere and the style.
Yeah.
More than it is the story.
I enjoy it.
The story is incredibly simple, and I really mean that. It's a very simple story. Yeah. And I think it's not even told all that well. The things I mentioned with the people being related to the conspirators, some elements of the actual ghost story itself, like the origin of the pirates, wasn't very clear. He had to go back in and add that opening sequence to sort of make it all come together. And even then, like I said, not everything is as clear as it really could be in this movie.
Yeah.
But I guess that's what he was going for, but it didn't necessarily make for great storytelling. And there's a few filmmaking moments I wonder, like, we have to watch Adrian Barbeau climb all 300 steps.
Yeah.
Like, that was the one time I was like,
what? Put it in my notes.
I was like, what are you doing, Carpenter? It felt like a film school thing to, like, let me show the desolation. Like, we get it.
Yeah. All right, you ready for reviews of this sucker?
Yes, I am. Oh, by the way, I'd give it a 7 out of 10. What would you give it?
7 out of 10.
So we're in agreement there. Yeah. 7 out of 10.
I enjoy
it. Not his best work, but I mean, if you enjoy horror movies, you should really check it out. Yeah. It's a solid recommend from the both of us.
4.3 user review, 75% on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's fair.
And a 6.8 out of a 10 on IMDb.
I thought it'd be a little higher, but I'm okay with that.
This rating is called rating -5 stars. No, make that -10 stars. This is a 1 star.
Review. I could see someone really just being bored to tears by this movie. So let's hear it.
Are you kidding me? This movie was so bad, I couldn't even make fun of how bad it was. And I'm like a professional when it comes to making fun of bad movies. It is not suspenseful, nor is it scary. We figured out within the first 10-15 minutes of the movie who was going to live and who was going to die. Here's the basic plot. Pirate ghost zombies, guys knock on people's doors just because they're evil pirate. He calls them gombies. Doesn't mean they're rude enough to break down a door. Wait for someone to answer and then kill them with a hook, because all pirates have hooks instead of hands. You never really got to see the gombies up close, except for the split second here and there, and the times I did get to see what they looked like, it looked like they were wearing Halloween costumes. It was like some people sat around and decided to come up with the absolute worst horror movie idea, got the worst script, writer, director, etc., and then made what I can honestly say is bad, that I actually apologized to my husband for renting it. One particular scene worth mentioning is when an old woman babysitting a radio DJ's son gets a knock on the door. She senses something evil is outside the door, I think because she hears the DJ screaming they're in danger over the radio. So she yells for the boy to run upstairs. Then she flings the door wide open and for some reason turns around so her back is towards the open door and just stands there for a few moments. Because what could possibly happen? I mean, if I feared some evil creature was outside and then heard a knock on the door, the first thing I'd do is go open it and turn my back. The Gombe would probably thinking, hey, could you at least make this a little bit of a challenge? You know, like try to run and let us chase you or something? For fans of this movie, it's okay you personally liked it, but at least have the decency not to recommend it to others.
And listen, if the atmosphere doesn't work for you at all, I can understand someone really hating this movie and thinking it's just boring garbage.
Yeah.
Because really, there aren't really graphic deaths, which is really another issue that they had while making the movie. They were sort of terrified by, they'd just seen David Cronenberg's Scanners, and they're like, oh my God, that's the kind of level of gore they're doing here? And they got really scared their movie wasn't going to be able to compete. And now it did, over time, people have grown to love this movie just as much as anybody that loves Scanners. And it doesn't necessarily matter, but I think it's kind of funny that at one point Carpenter was really worried about being out-goried, I guess, in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I find that kind of amusing today.
Yeah. I still, like I said, recommend this movie all wholeheartedly. I think it's a lot of fun. It's a good John Carpenter, not a great one, but what can you do?
Yeah, not everything is going to be The Thing or Big Trouble in Little China. Or
yeah.
I think In the Mouth of Madness is another movie I think is also of that quality.
Yeah. All right. Oh, fuck.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yes. In the year of our Lord, 1980, Roger Ebert was very much alive. And, of course, he reviewed The Fog.
Hmm.
He did not review the remake, but he reviewed this one. And do you think he liked it?
No.
Why not? Because it's amazing.
I don't think he likes horror movies.
You know, you're going to go with the typical opinion?
Yeah.
He hates all horror movies? Well, in this instance, you are correct. Siskel and Ebert did not give it a good review. That's right. I actually have both of them.
And this is pretty kid-friendly, I think.
Yeah, I mean, kind of. For the 80s, I guess. But yes, I do have both of them, Siskel and Ebert. Here is them on a very early installment of their show.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite movies from last year was a real bone chiller named Halloween, the work of a bright young director named John Carpenter, who's back this year with another thriller called The Fog. And if you watch this scene coming up, I think you'll see the Carpenter is trying to scare us all over again with the same basic story elements that were in Halloween. An isolated small town, a dark and ominous night, and a murderer that springs up out of nowhere like a homicidal jack-in-the-box. Well, I think once you see that sequence, you've seen the basic scare tactic of The Fog. People open doors, or they turn their backs, or they walk into a dark church, or they go down into the basement, and whammo! The Fog does have a storyline, a very thin storyline. It seems that a ship was wrecked on that coast 100 years ago that very night, and the townspeople at that time murdered the sailors, and the sailors vowed to return as ghosts a century later. Well, you gotta admit, as stories go, that will probably do. We don't demand stainless steel plausibility in a thriller, but we do enjoy a colorful and offbeat villain, and that's where The Fog disappointed me, because Fog itself just isn't that fascinating as a threat. It rolls in from the sea, it glows in the dark, it contains the ghosts of sailors, and so what? It's just too ungainly as a special effect to allow the kind of sharp-edged, split-second timing that was so frightening in Halloween. So the movie's well made, but it's just not merciless enough.
Exactly right. I mean, The Fog, who cares? It's not threatening at all. Also, the repetition of the same pattern of attack is really boring. Knock on the door, guy goes to the door, looks around, then when he least expects it, but we always expect it, gets it in the neck. It's pretty dull, as a matter of fact. Very disappointing from John Carpenter.
There's another thing here, too. I think Carpenter was depending upon the same kind of craft that he had in Halloween to make the movie work. He doesn't bother to really establish the characters in his town as people. One of the things that was interesting, for example, about Jaws, and to a degree to Halloween, was that we really got to know the people enough to care about them, but we don't care about these people in The Fog.
So we get boring characters killed off in boring ways.
Yeah. If you're looking for another movie like Halloween, this is not the movie to go see.
Exactly.
But Gene and I both voted no for The Fog. It just wasn't
scary enough. You heard it from there.
So it's either too intense or it's not enough?
It's like Goldilocks. It has to be the right amount of intense for the subject matter. And he said this was not the right amount, so thumbs down. Actually, there was no thumbs down at that point. Just a no. He voted no, we vote yes.
Yeah.
I like The Fog. I still do. This is a movie we'll probably still watch again in a couple years.
Yeah.
Never watch the remake again, but we will watch this other one. Oh, we watch the original over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We'll take care of it on Halloween or something.
Yeah, sure. Why not? It's a great movie.
All right.
And next week, Freddy Got Fingered. We're covering that.
No,
we're not doing that. Who knows what we're doing next week, but we know we have a show next week, guys. So we'll see you then.
Bye.